Over the coming months, the few parts of Antarctica that are ice-free will be the stage on which 5 million adelies will build their nests. To construct one, they need pebbles. And without a good-looking nest, a male will be unable to attract a female when they at last arrive. An impressive property demonstrates your worth as a mate. It takes stones of all shapes and sizes to build a decent nest, and finding ones that are just right is not easy. So some penguins turn to a life of crime. The one who has been robbed seems unaware that the thief is just over his shoulder and looking for more. The thief's nest is coming along nicely, probably because he keeps a particularly sharp lookout for robbers. After all, it takes one to know one.
So I'm guessing after we penetrate that surface layer of humor, most of you might have felt a certain level of moral outrage. I heard shame over here on this side watching that one. And was anybody rooting for the stealing penguin? Did anyone feel that the hardworking builder penguin was unjust in being mad and then a fight was going to ensue when he discovered the crime? You noticed even the narrator, Sir David Attenborough, changed his voice, right, when talking about the thief penguin. So why would we all feel that is the question. And I think because deep down you know stealing is wrong because materialism is wrong, right? I'm going to suggest the reason we all react the way we do on this is because it violates the rules of the dance. The dance is what C.S. Lewis and Tim Keller have used to describe the interaction and relationship that exists within the Trinity of God, yeah? And that we are invited as people to join into. That dance then extends out to human communities and maybe even to all of creation. It's something that we react to that goes beyond just individual opinion. I don't think it's right to steal. I don't. You might. I don't. It is something that's universal and maybe even sacred. And on this question of universal truths, things we can all understand, my family this summer has had a chance to visit some spectacular national parks. It's been a lot of fun. And in every great park, there are these roadside pullouts that are labeled viewpoint or scenic view. You've seen these along on the road? And I thought at one point after passing one of those, well, how exactly do they know what I want to look at, right? But the viewing areas, they're always packed with people. And Yosemite Valley's got a really famous one, tunnel view, right? And if you come through the tunnel into Yosemite Valley, for those of you who have done that, you get why. There are people standing there with their jaws dropped and they're taking pictures and they're speechless and they're just feeling awe looking at the pullout on tunnel view. Why there? Why not a half mile back? Why not a half mile farther on? It's that one spot and everybody gets it. I don't know how we know what a Grand Vista is, but I know we do know what a Grand Vista is. And if we don't, Well, then something has died in us for the older folks, or something has not yet been awakened for the babies, right? But the fully human being can always see beauty. And the road engineers know where to build the pullouts as a result. There is something transcendent, something beyond subjective tastes of the individual in our world. And when it comes to nature documentaries, David Attenborough is banking on this fact that there are transcendents. Okay. It's beyond just an innate recognition of beauty that I think of. He thinks we're going to see not only beauty that we can all agree on, but we can also recognize justice and injustice, which is what makes that kind of funny. It's why he shows the penguin clip, and why, if you notice, his voice changes when talking about the penguin thief. He knows, like we all feel something about a life of crime, where one takes for themselves the work of another. But from a purely biological standpoint, evolutionary standpoint, you know, it's not easy for an Adélie penguin to find the right stones in Antarctica to build an impressive nest to find a mate. So some penguins turn to a life of crime. He says it as though it was bad, as though it was an unnatural thing. But thief penguin and thief human could respond, this is actually the most effective strategy for me to survive in this world. It's perfectly natural. Even the penguins do it, right? Just as for the penguins, so too for the people. Throughout most of human history, and still in many, many places in the world, it's really hard to find enough food and resources to survive and raise offspring, right? Historically speaking, we kind of live in our country in this moment in an unusual time when the accumulation of property, of rocks in our nest, doesn't feel directly linked to our ability to live for one more generation or even for one more day. But there are times when taking from others seems not only the easiest way to survive, but maybe the only way to survive. In modern America, we don't really face this predicament much, but the heart of today's command is still going to apply, and the desire to take from others is still ingrained in us. So this morning we're going to turn to the eighth of the Ten Commandments. As mentioned, my name is Keith Carls, and I sometimes get to lead a class here at church, and I'm a lawyer by day, so they thought, okay, we're going to give you stealing, and we want you to tackle that. So we're going to be in Exodus 20. For you all want to turn there, we'll be there for a blink of an eye. And we're going to look, starting as we do in this series, verses 1 and 2, and then we're going to jump all the way to 15, which takes a long time. Here it goes. Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, You shall not steal. Okay, you're done. This one seems so simple, right? I told a friend what the message was going to be on, and he said, can't you just read the verse and say, don't steal stuff, and then amen and have communion? And there is a certain straightforwardness to it. You know when something is not yours. You know when something is yours. So, church, this is important. If something is not yours, don't take it. That's our message today, right? Now, if that is so simple, why does it even need to be said, and why does it seem to be broken so consistently throughout human and possibly penguin history for all time? We see in this series these Ten Commandments, you break them down often into kind of two sections, relationship with God and relationship with people. There's love God and love your neighbor as we turn to the New Testament. And the first three commandments are definitely God relationship ones. The fourth and fifth are fun because they kind of have a hybrid going on. They're starting to transition. And then we get to commands 6 through 8 this week and the last few. And these seem very human focused. No murder, no adultery, no stealing. And at a certain level, they all seem so obviously good rules for conducting civilized society. You think, well, even in a world without a God, we'd probably adopt those, whereas commands 1 through 3 would make absolutely no sense if we didn't have a God. Allowing commands 6 through 8, murder, adultery, and stealing behaviors in a society would lead to total chaos and war at all times. Civilization, human flourishing require a respect for others' lives, their relationships, and their property. And so, as we learned this morning, not taking their property is a sign of that respect. Why do we have such a tough time of showing that respect? Well, unlike our last two commandments, murder and adultery, I don't think we have such a tough time because we don't really know what God means by don't steal. We know exactly what he means, right? And we've heard in the last couple of weeks, getting through these adultery and murder passages, Jesus kind of expands on and gives us a bit more of what is meant by those. Both times we turn back up to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, and we heard a much more detailed explanation of what these old commands meant. Jesus was saying, and by don't murder, I mean don't even get angry. Don't call someone a fool or you'll go to hell. That's in 5:22. And he then says, and by don't commit adultery, I mean don't even lust in 5:28. And then, especially if you're preparing this morning's sermon, you'd expect Jesus to say, and by don't steal, I mean what? And it isn't there. He skips right into something that's going to be more like commandment 9 and talks about false vows. So not even Jesus' Sermon on the Mount seems to have felt the need to explain not stealing in more detail. What's going on there? Well, in our society, we have a number of ways to explain the rules, right? And the most well-known is the legislature, like Congress, passes a bill, and the old-timers are thinking, I'm just a bill, just a lonely old bill sitting here on Capitol Hill. And the executive signs it, and that makes it a law, and that means everybody has to follow it. But far more prevalent is the legal authority of regulations. Yeah, everybody likes those. Regulations get passed by agencies, not by Congress, right? And what regulations do is they try to help explain and clarify the law's specifics. And it turns out you need a lot more explaining of the laws than actual laws, okay? I tried to look up, for illustrative purposes this morning, federal laws and regulations in America that we have to follow. Here's what I found. When federal laws were first codified in 1927, they fit into a single volume. By the 1980s, these are the laws, by the 1980s, there were 50 volumes of more than 23,000 pages. And today, online sources say that no one knows. That's just federal. Remember, we've got state and local. That's fun. Okay, so that's the laws, and now we have to explain the 23,000 pages or more. So then we have federal regulations. How many are there? No one knows. There are roughly 200,000 pages dealing with major regulations, but the minor ones don't even get published in the first place. 200,000 pages of major regulations to explain 23,000 pages of laws in the federal system alone. There are regulations on dentists, guns, smog. If you're in my small group, you know hexavalent chrome. Even on trampolines, there are regulations to explain everything, do everything, and use everything. So some laws require a lot more detailed explanation, and we see this with the Ten Commandments. Some get this more detailed dive, but not so with stealing, right? It's never okay to steal. Now, if we move forward to Exodus 22, it doesn't say stealing's okay, but it does kind of lay out different penalties for different types of stealing, whether you're a robber or a thief in the night and all these sorts of things. And I think what we see is that in the Ten Commandments, Jesus explains, he's going beyond the mere action God originally prohibited to get to the heart condition leading to the action. And so with murder and adultery, you have anger and lust. That's what we saw the last couple of weeks. But for some reason that we're hopefully going to learn in 2 more weeks, the Ten Commandments have both the action against stealing and also the heart command that links to it, coveting, right? It's already in the Old Testament. Not only shall you not steal, but you shall not covet. And it's almost impossible to steal without the heart condition of coveting. With stealing, then, we don't have to wait for the Sermon on the Mount to explain the heart problem. We just get it two commands later. So what exactly do you all think is so bad about stealing, and what makes it keep happening throughout our history? Part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that there is a God. Part of it has to do with the fact that our God is a triune God, Trinity. And part of it is found in mankind's creation. Quickly, we're going to cover some ground. Without any God, the individual would have to obey the law of self. Do what's best for you in each and every instance. But with God, rules beyond self and our immediate needs start to make some sense. And with a triune God, three-person God, we have to think of community, of relationship at the very center of our concept of God. Our God, because he is triune, is always in relationship and always has been. And then lastly, we get to our own creation. And I take this from Genesis 1. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over all the earth." God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them. Then God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed, it shall be food for you." So that's a lot of where we're going this morning. Only if there is a God can we all react to beauty and to evil. We all view and like the view in Yosemite coming through the tunnel, and we all think the second penguin was wrong. If there's no God, though, we all just have whatever biologically determined tastes and preferences that we have, and morality doesn't really exist beyond doing what's best for you. And if there's a triune God, then we have something greater than our mere material existence that draws us beyond nature. If that God is in three persons and always has been, whereas creation, matter, material, has not always been, but a triune God has always been, then loving relationship and community is primary, and accumulating material is secondary. And if we're created in the image of that God, then loving relationship, rather than material possession, is not just God's first care, but it's ours too. So we have to fast forward to the third chapter of Genesis. The first humans have all they need. They can eat from any tree except for that one, right? I've given you everything for food, we just read. And for reasons that cannot be explained materially, Adam and Eve weren't starving, right? They had ample food in the garden. But for reasons that can only be explained relationally, they eat the forbidden fruit. It was an early form of stealing, you might say. They ate what was not theirs to eat, not out of hunger, right, but out of a desire to be God. By their actions, they said, "We don't trust in the provision of God. We will use our hands to take what we want, even that which we did not create or earn." And in that moment, though it's not stated, they had to think one of two things. One, God is not powerful enough to provide for me. And they had no reason up to that point in history to think that, because he had always provided. They had no evidence for that position. Or the second thing they may have thought is God was not loving enough and was trying to get something from them rather than give something to them by giving them that command. On the second idea, that he's taking, not giving, they start thinking, well, there must be some fruit. There must be some material possession in this world that will satisfy us even more than right relationship with God. He must be holding something back from us. There must be something better than God. And that message was, of course, reinforced by the serpent. And this introduces what I think is maybe the biggest ism problem we have in our country and maybe our world today. You know, we read a lot about sexism and racism and various other isms with a lot of frequency in the news. They're in front of us. But if I were to name a moral plague on our country and our church greater than any other, and that leads to the others, I would say it's materialism. Church, in addition to our sins against other people, where we just see them not as the image of God, but as the biological distinctives they possess only, in addition to that, we also see the creation as the greater source of happiness than the God who made it. Imagine, though, if there was a peace and joy you could experience that was greater than getting every material thing you ever wanted, that was greater than the joy when you push back from the best Thanksgiving meal you've ever eaten, that was greater than the joy of the new car smell of the car you've been saving up for years, right? What if there is a joy out there that is greater than when you finally filled that retirement account to the brim? What if there's a joy greater than when you finally get out of that credit card debt or your student loans? There's two types of people in this world, and you can't define them by their socioeconomic status, their education, their religious affiliation, their ethnicity, or their moral behavior. There are those that come to see something beyond the physical, the material, the created, and there are those who don't. Jesus was crucified between these two types of people. He was not crucified between two murderers. Murder is a really big crime. He wasn't crucified between two adulterers. And that's always been a big crime. There have even been laws that allow people to murder people who are committing adultery, right? Those are a big deal. But those behaviors, those criminal violations are human relationship created. But Jesus is between two people who just stole stuff. They just took things. They just took material. It's not relational. It was so boiled down from humanity, from God. It was just stuff. And that's who Jesus gets crucified between. Jesus was crucified between two robbers, two people who stole. And that wasn't, by the way, usually a capital crime in Israel. It's not death penalty stuff in Israel's history. They were two unnamed robbers bookending the Lord of the universe on Calvary at the center point of all history. What are they doing there? It seems he should have had the stage maybe to himself in that moment. What are these two eighth commandment breakers doing there? I want to turn to the story, try to unpack that a little bit. And you have to cover a few gospel accounts to piece it together. And we'll start in Matthew 27, verse 8. At that time, two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. Same description in Mark chapter 15, 27. So in Matthew and Mark, they give us the crime along with Jesus' crime of being king of the Jews. Now, in John's gospel, he just says there are two men, and when the time comes, their legs are broken. That's all we know from John. Now, Luke, he just calls them criminals. He doesn't specify their crime, so you got to kind of piece these all together to know what's happening here. But what Luke does is he gives us the conversations they have with Jesus, and there are two very distinct conversations. Here's Luke's version, and I want you to just remember back to Matthew and Mark. These are people who stole. So from Luke 23, verse 3, and continuing. When they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left. But Jesus was saying, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves. And the people stood by, kind of willing accomplices, looking on. And even the rulers were sneering at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself." Remember that phrase. "If this is the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." Now there was also an inscription above him, "This is the king of the Jews." One of the criminals who were hanged there was hurling abuse at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. So what is that first robber, that first thief about? Well, he's about the same thing as the rulers, let him save himself. He's the same thing as the soldiers, let him save the self. And all the people who are looking on the thief, save yourself and us. Because I mentioned before, there's two types of people, right, in this world. And they can't be defined by these externals that we always look to, right? In this story, we see Jews and Romans, leaders and followers, the educated and the masses, the wealthy and the poor, and those that have followed the law, and those that have enforced the law, and those that have broken the law and been punished for it, and they're all saying the same thing. Save yourself. Save yourself is repeated three times in this section by all sorts of different people, right? Be your own God. Care not for others. And then there's the other robber. And here's his story, picking up in verse 40. But the other answered and rebuking him said, do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed are suffering justly. For we are receiving what we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. And he was saying, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise. Two criminals, the same crime they stole, facing the same punishment, crucifixion, looking at the same Jesus. One responds as the rulers, the soldiers, the Romans, the Jews, the onlookers do, with materialism. Take matters into your own hands. Indeed, take matter into your own hands and save yourself. To these sort of people, you can do no greater good than preserving your material existence. You are God. Do it yourself. And then there is the other response. I'm guilty, but there is a kingdom to come. It is beyond nature and my material desires. Please show me mercy. I will die, and justly so, for my actions, but I can recognize and fear God, and he can help me. Those are the two, what I call, economies of this world. Thief one, thief two, natural and supernatural. Rock piles and stealing loaves of bread versus fasting and being tended to, although God's economy is ultimately logical. There must be faith that despite what is seen, material, trusting in God's commands is better than trying to save yourself. And in this eighth commandment, I think we see the very heart of the battle that's been raging since the Garden of Eden. If material is all we can hope for, there is logic in stealing as long as you don't get caught. But if there is something else, something supernatural that matters more than nature, then all you're doing is screaming, I'm going to go get mine, and I'm going to save myself, when in reality you can't. And that leads to the deterioration of your soul and some really bad outcomes. It's not just taking someone else's property, right? It's the decay that comes when all you can see is their material but not their personhood. It affects all of your being. You're reduced from human to animal, maybe an Adelie penguin. You see stuff, but not spirit. You see Yosemite's rocks, but not its beauty. And you know how we know about this decay, again from John's gospel in the 12th chapter, verse 3. Mary then took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples who was intending to betray him, said, why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people? Now, he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. Now, this is six chapters before the betrayal. Judas was first a thief. Judas saw the power of money, the money box, and missed the power of the Lord. This isn't caring about the poor more than beauty. It's caring about neither, nothing but self. As this beautiful moment of Jesus' anointing and a fragrance filling the whole house happens, he can't see it and he can't smell it. He's dying. He just sees the lost chance for more money. And it's money that he will ultimately trade for human life. and even God's own son's life. He's lost the miracles, the teachings, the compassion, and the healings. He will save himself even though a savior is sitting right next to him. All he can see is the economy of this world, not the next. Earn for yourself, take what you can get now. But that's not what we're called to. Those in God's economy know someone else will save them. So they're going to heed what Jesus says in Matthew 6. Don't store up for yourself treasures on earth where moss and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasure in heaven where none of that happens. There's no thieves. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And what is this great treasure in heaven? Well, it's being part of that dance I mentioned before. God is three persons in love. It starts with the Father's love for the Son and the sons of the Father and the manifestation of the Spirit out of that love. Their love is love from eternity. That love is then expressed in creation. And man is told to enter into God's love and spread it throughout the earth. God did not create to be loved. He created to show his love. Everything he made is his, including us. He doesn't need us to not steal. We need to not steal. Because only then are we entering into the love that realizes how good God is for those that fear him. Psalm 50 makes this clear. Here's what the Lord says. For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you. For the world is mine and all it contains. God doesn't need our sacrifices or our obedience to make him fully God. If he needed something, he wouldn't even tell us. He's not stealing from us. It's all his. And the love and power he has, he willingly shares with his people. So we don't need to steal from others. But we don't really hear that. We don't fully understand this idea of ignoring material desires for our spiritual reality. And as you've noticed, we've started these messages on the Ten Commandments in Exodus 2, God's deliverance from Egypt. And that deliverance passage can work a couple of ways. You could look at that and see thou shalt not steal as our required payment for being freed from slavery. Well, I'd like to steal that new car, which I'd enjoy, or illegally download a song, or scam the IRS on my taxes, but I owe it to God. Ever since Egypt, he's always been holding me back. Or we can see verse 2. As a confirmation of God's power and ability to save us, he's provided for us. I have a history here, people. I can save you. You can't. So that we don't have to look at things and think, I better save myself. I better grab that. And I think the other important thing, though, in this series that we want to consider isn't just the verses before the Ten Commandments, but also those that come right afterwards. Here's what it says in verse 18. All the people perceived, now this is as Moses is receiving the Ten Commandments. All the people perceived the thunder and lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. Then they said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen, but let not God speak to us or we will die. Moses can hear God's words. The people hear just thunder and trumpets. They see lightning and smoke. They are afraid. They don't hear his voice on this. And so I think we too have trouble hearing, and we fear trusting in his provision. And so did Adam and Eve, and so did Judas. You feel this strong urge in this material life, in these material bodies. And it can be really hard to trust in the unseen when we can see physical existence. We have trouble trusting that there is a promise of something even better than the best in the world, whether purchased or stolen. It helps to trust this unseen goodness and love for us by realizing God has always had love. Now, if God was unipersonal, just not the Trinity, then before the world came into existence, there could have been no love because there was nothing to love. And that would make God's essence about power, not about relationship and love. All right, and if that's the case, if he's really about power in the commandments, he's just given us commands to have us acknowledge universally that, okay, God's the boss, I'm not. And they likely wouldn't have a loving instruction for your good if this was just a power display, forcing obedience. And on the other end of the things, if there is no God at all, then really all moral commands are just subjective. But if a triune God is living out his love, not stealing isn't just pure moralism for God's ego trip. It is a prescription to right living for our sake, his people's sake. So as Lewis points out, and he says at the risk of seeming irreverent, we have a dancing triune God, a God in relationship within the Trinity, dynamic, moving, in love in the Trinity. And in his image, we are called to live in that relational love and then spread it across the earth. We dance, we don't steal. Meaning, we are about spreading love rather than hoarding stones in Antarctica. Tim Keller explained it this way, which I liked. But if God was triune forever, then ultimate reality is a community of persons knowing and loving each other. Then that means ultimate reality is about loving relationships. It is therefore not about material progress outside the bounds of loving relationships. You don't steal from those you love. And not only shall we not steal, there is nothing to steal. God has given us everything we need. And what we really need is him, not mere possessions. He offers himself to us again this morning at this table. So I want to move to our time of communion. I'm going to read two scenes, which mercifully I will not sing, from Les Mis. Both involve the thief, Jean Valjean, for those familiar with it. For those not, he's been in prison 19 years for stealing a loaf of bread to feed his family. Stealing led to prison. Prison led to bitterness. Bitterness to hatred of the world, which then led him to steal again, this time from a church. Like Judas, stealing led to his soul dying. But then he encounters the bishop in the church who offers mercy to him for his crime. The bishop could send him back to jail, but instead gives him what he stole and tells him to use it for good, right? So it starts as he's being released from his 19 years for stealing a loaf of bread from the cop, the law, Javert. And he always calls Valjean by his prisoner number, not his name, Javert. Now bring me prisoner 24601. Your time is up and your parole's begun. You know what that means, Valjean. Yes, it means I'm free. No, it means you get your yellow ticket of leave, his parole papers. You are a thief. I stole a loaf of bread. You robbed a house. I broke a window pane. My sister's child was close to death and we were starving. You will starve again unless you learn the meaning of the law. I know the meaning of those 19 years, a slave of the law. 5 years for what you did and the rest because you tried to run. Yes, 24601. My name is Jean Valjean, and I am Javert. Do not forget my name. Do not forget me, 24601. To which all the other prisoners sing out, look down, look down. You'll always be a slave. Look down, look down. You're standing in your grave. And then we fast forward to that law, from that law scene to the church with the bishop, and he's taking the silver off the table. And he's fleeing, and he gets caught, and the bishop says, no, 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 I gave it to him. Let him go, cops. And this is how the bishop addresses Valjean in that moment. But remember this, my brother. See in this act of mercy some higher plan. You must use this precious silver to become an honest man. By the witness of the martyrs, by the passion and the blood, God has raised you out of darkness. I have bought your soul for God. Valjean, what have I done? Sweet Jesus, what have I done? Become a thief in the night, become a dog on the run, and I have fallen so far, and is the hour so late, that nothing remains but the cry of my hate. The cries in the dark that nobody hears, here where I stand at the turning of the years. If there's another way to go, I missed it 20 long years ago. My life was a war that could never be won. They gave me a number and murdered Valjean. When they chained me and left me for dead just for stealing a mouthful of bread. Yet why did I allow that man, the bishop, to touch my soul and teach me love? He treated me like any other. He gave me his trust. He called me brother. My life, he claims, for God above. Can such things be? For I had come to hate the world, this world that always hated me. Take an eye for an eye. Turn your heart into stone. This is all I have lived for. This is all I have known. One, I feel my shame inside me like a knife. He told me that I have a soul. How does he know? That what spirit comes to move my life? Is there another way to go? I am reaching, but I fall, and the night is closing in, and I stare into the void, to the whirlpool of my sin. I'll escape now from the world of Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean is nothing now. Another story must begin. And he tears up his being bound to the law and lives a life of mercy and grace. So if we steal because we want or we think we need beyond what God provides, we are thief one on the cross. If we don't steal because we think God is our overlord and wants or needs something from us, we are under the law and standing in our graves. But if we see that there's another sort of thief, one that recognizes the error of his ways and begs for mercy, then we are thief two and waiting for paradise. And like Valjean, another story is set to begin. God has promised to provide all we need this day, and we can have confidence he will provide as he gave his only son, which is far more precious than the bishop's silver. At this table here, we join the eternal heavenly feast. We receive all we ever need, Christ's body broken for you, and his blood shed for the forgiveness of our sins. Thieves, come and join the feast. Come and enter the dance of the Trinity.